Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. For the first time, U.S. arrests along the Mexican border have topped 2 million. The numbers are driven in part by a huge increase in the number of people coming from countries like Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. In fact, just last week, two plane loads of Venezuelan asylum seekers landed on Martha's Vineyard, their trip paid for by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The governor's actions have renewed the ongoing debate over immigration reform and why, after decades of failed attempts, we can't seem to identify a solution that is both humane and in keeping with national security interests. This hour, why the immigration system is broken and what needs to be done to fix it. Our guests are Teresa Cardinal Brown, Managing Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She served as an immigration policy official during both the Bush and Obama administrations. Teresa, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
And also with us is Hamid Aliaziz, who covers immigration policy for the Los Angeles Times. Prior to that, he worked for BuzzFeed News, where he regularly broke news on the immigration policies of the Trump and then Biden administrations. Hamid, welcome to Radio Times.
Excited to be here.
So I'll start with you, Hamid, because I want to begin by talking about the events of last week around Governor Ron DeSantis. Remind us what happened when the governor sent those plane loads of Venezuelan asylum seekers to New England.
Yeah, I mean, what we saw was that local officials were not prepared. They said they had no heads up that this plane load of around 50, you know, primarily Venezuelans were arriving in this tiny community, and it caused alarm. It was surprising, and there was, you know, some concern around, you know, the lack of heads up, especially to a state where there's a GOP governor. And because this is such a small community, it was a real crisis moment for Martha's Vineyard.
And the community did rise to the occasion.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's lots of, examples, reports where, you know, the community got together and was helping people get shelter and clothing and food. So it's one of these rallying points for Martha's Vineyard.
And Teresa, this is not the first or only time in recent memory that a Southern lawmaker has sent asylum seekers, refugees out of their state recently and up north, correct? I mean, we've seen this before.
Well, yeah. I mean, Governor Abbott of Texas, starting in April, started getting migrants, asylum seekers who were released from DHS custody at the border and busing them to New York City, to Washington, D.C., and most recently to Chicago. Governor Ducey of Arizona also has been busing migrants out of his state as well, although hasn't made as much of, a national public announcement of it. I would clarify one thing. These are asylum seekers. They are people who have come to the border, have been encountered by Customs and Border Protection, processed for appearances before immigration court to ask for asylum. They're not technically refugees yet because that asylum case hasn't been decided. So they are asylum seekers in technical terms, yes.
Got it. And Teresa, Governor DeSantis has said that, you know, southern states bear, so much expense and so much difficulty in processing all of these asylum seekers that they bear the biggest burden. Is that actually the case?
I think it's very true in the case of Texas and Arizona, the states right along the border where migrants are immediately arriving. And they're arriving to very small towns, Yuma, Arizona, Eagle Pass, Texas, Del Rio, McAllen. These towns are, a few thousand people. If they're lucky, they have one commercial bus station that can transport people out of their towns. And they have been managing, tens of thousands of arrivals now for years in these small locations. So I do think that there is a point. They have been managing it, though. And I think it's also important to say that, the locals, officials, the towns, the nonprofit communities have created shelters, and they've kind of created an infrastructure and a process around this now. But that burden of immediate entry falls there. Less so in Florida. Florida is the first place of arrival for migrants, oftentimes who arrive by boat, primarily from Haiti and Cuba. It is a secondary location for some migrants that cross the border, but I don't think they have seen the intensity in the smaller locations that you have seen maybe in Texas and Arizona.
And Hamid, as I mentioned earlier, the governor is now facing a class action lawsuit on behalf of the Venezuelan migrants. What are they alleging here?
Yeah, I mean, they're alleging, I believe, some level of fraud took place. And, you know, it's important to note that since that lawsuit was filed, we haven't seen another flight. There were, you know, there was discussion around another flight landing in Delaware, obviously the home state of President Biden, but we haven't seen another flight since last week. And the real question now is whether, you know, the governor has gotten his point across, his action, and he feels like he's got enough media attention around it and is moving away from it, or we're just going to continue to see flights going to Martha's Vineyard or, you know, other places like California or New York City.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens with the other lawsuit. There's a Democratic lawmaker, as we mentioned, who is also suing to try to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you see this, I think, you know, obviously, I don't think the governor is dissuaded by the media attention or the outrage from certain sectors of the country around this action. But could this legal action, especially this idea from the local lawmaker, push the governor to maybe take a second to think about these flights? That'll be really interesting to see.
And Teresa, again, this is not the first time that we've seen this historically. It does sort of recall the reverse freedom rides from the early 60s when segregationists were tricking black people in the South into getting on buses going north.
Well, I think what we're seeing here, and clearly the intention of Governor Abbott and Governor DeSantis by publicizing these flights so much and talking about them in the media, is to use the them as political points, which I think is not, I personally think that's deplorable. Even if it's true, as I mentioned, that these small communities have been bearing the brunt, it's clear that by, for example, busing them, and they say this, the governors say this in their press statements, we're busing them to sanctuary cities, we're busing them to democratic cities, we're busing them to the vice president's home because she's supposed to be in charge, and we're doing this so that, you know, people know what's going on here and the policies will change. So they're definitely trying to make political points on the backs of very vulnerable people, and by doing so, putting them, at least in the case of the Martha's Vineyard flight, in more vulnerable positions. I think that, you know, taking a step back and setting aside any fraud that may be involved, it is true that New York or Washington, D.C. or Chicago have much more opportunities to help the migrants get to their ultimate destinations in the country than, you know, buses out of some of these small towns. They also have the capacity for much more response in terms of services and help with clothing and food and shelter and those things than some of these smaller towns do. So in some ways, if it wasn't so political, it could be seen as a help to some of these migrants, as long as they aren't being, they're not being lied to, they're not being deceived in what's happening to them.
Yeah. And Hamid, is there a way to tell yet from your vantage point whether the actions that the governor took have done much beyond riling up his base, or do you think that we may see further federal action to try to acknowledge the broken system that we're living in, that this might be a catalyst? Is there a way to know that at this point?
Yeah, I don't think there's any way to know that. I think one thing is clear, that the governor, like former President Trump, recognizes that immigration is a topic that ignites his base, the GOP base, and he is going to continue to focus on it. And this, you know, this effort was one way for him to get on the national stage with immigration. Like, you know, Teresa mentioned, Florida not being a state where there's immigrants crossing the border like Texas and Arizona, but he just inserted himself into the border issue and made himself a real, you know, major figure on immigration.
And Teresa, to you, the central question of this conversation, which is, why are we still having this conversation after so many decades? Why have we not been able to establish meaningful immigration reform that seems to work more or less for everyone concerned?
I think, you know, it seems like an easy question, but it has a very complicated set of answers. And I think one of the basic questions is how different people define immigration reform, right? You know, there was this idea starting back in the late 1990s when I started working in immigration policy of comprehensive immigration reform. And that was understood to be reforms that included not just securing the border or managing what's happening at the border, but changing our legal immigration system, reforming our legal immigration system, which hasn't been really updated since 1990, and, you know, addressing the status of what are now, you know, 10 to 11 million undocumented people in the United States. The combination of those ideas was meant to try to, one, address all of the pieces of the immigration system that people felt were broken in some way and needed reform, but also to address the priorities of all of the different stakeholders and all of the different, you know, political parties in this to try to grow enough support to get it passed in Congress, which is the ultimate need, right? Congress is the one that has to do a lot of this. I think over time, you know, that idea of comprehensive reform has been tried several times and not succeeded. And so people are now looking at smaller things. But I think also that idea of comprehensive immigration reform has been diluted in somewhat. I think among many Democrats, certainly among progressive Democrats and immigration advocates, it's shorthand for legalization, which is their highest priority. That's what they really want to see. Meanwhile, Republicans are saying, even if we would be okay with that, and many of them are, we can't possibly think about legalizing a lot of people unless we are sure that somehow we are going to be able to not see another 10 or 11 million people in an undocumented status in the future. And we think we do that by enforcing security at the border and stopping more undocumented migration. I think the complicating factor right now is that what was seen as border security, say in 2013, which is the last time Congress seriously attempted a big comprehensive bill, which was really about addressing migrants mainly from Mexico who are trying to sneak across for work. Now we are looking at a majority of migrants, not from Mexico, not trying to escape detection, but turning themselves in and seeking asylum. That's a fundamental shift in what's happening at our border. And securing the border and managing this migration is probably going to look a lot different than, say, in 2013, spending $60 billion on more Border Patrol agents, a wall, and fences.
Yeah. Well, and the demographics of who's coming are changing as well. We have to take a quick break here, but I'd like to continue that thought, Teresa. When we come back, we invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. We are talking about immigration reform. Of course, it has been put back on the front burner after some actions by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis last week when he sent two plane loads of Venezuelan migrants to Martha's Vineyard. And of course, that has restarted the ongoing debate about immigration reform and why we can't seem to come up with a solution that works reasonably well for all of the stakeholders who are concerned. Our guests this hour are Teresa Cardinal Brown, Managing Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And also with us is Hamed Ali Aziz, who covers immigration policy for the Los Angeles Times. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation as well. You can shoot us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. You can always call us too at 888-477-9499. Teresa Cardinal Brown, just before the break, you were talking about, you know, sort of the central question here, which is why we've not been able to come up with a workable solution and what a complicated answer there is to that question. And you were just starting to talk about sort of the shift that we're beginning to see as it relates to immigration. I'd like you to finish that thought and then we'll go from there.
Sure, sure. So for most of the many decades that we have been enforcing our U.S.-Mexico border against immigration, and it's worth noting the Border Patrol was not founded until 1924, so before that it was basically open, the vast majority, 90+% of everybody that Border Patrol encountered at that border were Mexicans. And what that meant was that we developed our infrastructure, our processes to be able to very quickly return them to Mexico, oftentimes within a matter of hours, sometimes a day or two. That no longer becomes the case when you encounter people who aren't from Mexico, because Mexico would not have to take back anyone that's not their citizens any more than the U.S. would have to take back to our territory somebody from Mexico who happened to go from here to there. So when somebody not from Mexico was encountered, they would have to go through a formal deportation process, whether that is in front of an immigration judge or something called expedited removal, and then would have to be sent by the United States government, if they aren't allowed to stay, to their home country. And that involves working with that home country to document that they are a citizen of that country and then transporting them there, usually by plane or some other method. And that takes longer. That's not a problem when the numbers of non-Mexicans are relatively tiny comparatively, but starting in the mid-2010s, around 2014, when we started seeing first unaccompanied minors from Central America and then full families from Central America who literally walked up to Border Patrol agents and said, and turned themselves in and said, "I want asylum." And that triggers a whole other set of processes. And again, wouldn't be a problem except in the numbers. And that has continued till now. And now not only Central Americans, but as we noted, Venezuelans and Cubans and others from South America, Ukrainians and Russians, people from Cameroon and Congo and India and Romania, from 100+ countries. And that just has not, our systems and infrastructure were not designed for that. And nor has our asylum system been designed for all of that volume. And that breakdown is, one, I think, encouraging the smugglers to encourage more people to come, but also making it much, much harder for us to actually manage what's happening down there.
And Hamid, you have covered both the Trump administration and the Biden administration's policies around immigration. During the Trump administration, immigration was a big priority. Trying to severely limit the number of people coming in was a big priority. Can you talk a bit about that and some of the measures that the Trump administration took to try to address the very issues that Teresa just described?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw right away with, day two or three of the Trump administration implementing the so-called Muslim ban. But beyond that, the Trump administration became really focused on the border and figuring out a way to limit the number of people coming across and seeking asylum. Obviously, they tried the policy that is colloquially known as a family separation. That was ultimately blocked by a federal court. And after that, they were still trying all kinds of ways to block asylum seekers from entering the United States. It was really a continuous effort to stop, at that time, primarily Central Americans from entering the U.S. and seeking asylum. I mean, one of the measures they tried was if you pass through a country where, you know, there was an effort that you had an opportunity to seek asylum and you did not, then you would not be allowed to enter the U.S. That was also blocked by a federal court. But that was their, main focus, really, was the border and stopping people from seeking asylum. And when the pandemic happened, they were offered an opportunity to do this with this measure called Title 42, which allows border agents to immediately expel, turn around migrants even asylum seekers and doesn't offer them the same asylum protections that have historically been offered due to the pandemic and trying to limit the number of people in U.S. custody.
And there was also the Remain in Mexico policy as well. What was that, and is that still in effect?
Yes, there was the Remain in Mexico policy. That was one of the measures where the asylum seekers would have to remain in Mexico while their asylum case in the United States proceeded. There were all kinds of humanitarian issues with Remain in Mexico. There were groups who were documenting migrants being kidnapped and assaulted and raped in these border towns while they were waiting for their asylum cases. And that was one of the main reasons why the Biden administration ultimately decided to undo Remain in Mexico. They recognized that there may have been some dip in the numbers of people coming to the border as a result of Remain in Mexico, but that the humanitarian drawbacks of this policy were just too great to continue it. And they tried to undo it, and they did for a period of time before a federal court forced them to bring the policy back. And then ultimately, this past June, the Supreme Court allowed the Biden administration to formally undo Remain in Mexico. And as of today, Remain in Mexico is not in place.
And I want to talk a little bit more later in our conversation about how the Biden administration is handling immigration and sort of the pressure that it is feeling from multiple sides. But in keeping with what we've been talking about and what people were experiencing through, for instance, the Remain in Mexico policy, Teresa Cardinal Brown, I want to ask you about the kinds of conditions people are facing that would cause them to do what you described. You talked about families coming in from Central America, just, you know, turning themselves in. What is happening that would cause people to cross one or more countries on foot with their families and or swim across rivers or pay large sums of money to smugglers in order to get to another place? What are they fleeing from?
So, again, kind of understanding the shift that we've seen at the border, you know, traditionally most people trying to cross the border were seeking work. They were seeking higher wages. They were seeking, you know, a better life. Many Mexicans over the years would come to the United States and work for a period of time, earn money, send it back to their families in Mexico, and then return to Mexico and do that, what we called circularity. But I think, you know, again, since the mid-1990s, some of those patterns have changed, partially because we have made the border much harder to cross. And so for many of those folks, they, instead of crossing regularly, they remained in the United States. And eventually many of their families wanted to come. That was still majority Mexicans, I think. The main difference, I think, now with the populations that we're seeing is that they just seem much more desperate and fleeing much more desperate situations. Mm-hmm. Many of them have been subject to criminal gang activity, extortion, rapes, murders of close family members, threats that really make them fear for their lives, that their governments are unable or unwilling to control. We have seen people whose livelihoods have been essentially torn away by devastating hurricanes or floods or mudslides, effects of climate change. In some cases, especially as we're looking at the groups of Venezuelans, Cubans, and Nicaraguans, it's, you know, some of the more what you might think of traditional refugee populations fleeing oppressive governments and threats against them. But I think the main difference is just the level of desperation. Ahmed can probably tell you from interviewing the migrants, many of them will say, I had to leave or I or my child would die. And that level of desperation is one that it's very hard to create deterrence for, right? Yeah. It's not that they don't know how dangerous the travel is. They really feel they have absolutely no choice but to try.
And Hamid, on that point, what have you heard as you have talked to people who have made that very difficult decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been many people who've felt targeted by gangs or have been targeted by gangs who, you know, have had no opportunity to feel safe in their home countries. And, you know, obviously, when you look at Venezuela, it's a country that, you know, there's been a lot of American attention on, and even during the Trump administration. You see a, you know, the president there who's been alleged to have committed crimes against humanity, against the opposition. You know, it's really a desperate situation here, to, like Teresa was saying, that that's forcing immigrants to take an often really dangerous journey.
Now, Teresa, I mentioned earlier that we had hit this milestone of more than 2 million people being apprehended at the border this year. And I guess that that number can be viewed as a success or viewed as a failure, depending on your perspective, right?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, the Border Patrol has measured what they call apprehensions at the border. And traditionally, apprehensions meant people trying to sneak through that we encountered and arrested, right? Now that Title 42 is in place, and now that many more people are actually turning themselves in, we have this term encounters, which includes both people who are expelled back to Mexico and people that are arrested and put in some sort of immigration proceedings. But I think the challenge with that as a metric of border security is that, particularly if you're looking at people who are trying to sneak in, you could argue that when that number goes up, you're more successful at catching people, or that there's more people trying and maybe you would have missed it. But if the number goes down, see, we're deterring people from coming, right? So if a measure that of success that it, you can spin as positive no matter which direction it goes, is not a great measure of success. And I think when you add to that the idea that many, many more people are actually waiting for Border Patrol and turning themselves in, you know, that number of, you know, apprehensions as a success changes, right? Because you're not talking about people that otherwise would not be eligible to enter. They're people that are entering maybe illegally, but once here they have a valid ability under our law to ask for asylum. Yeah. Doesn't mean they'll get it, but they do have that ability. And that means that number of encounters is somewhat different. Where it does matter, though, as a number and as a volume of people, is for our capacity to manage it. And at 2 million encounters, that's 2 million times Border Patrol and our immigration courts and all of the other parts of our system have to deal with a person. And that is straining, as I mentioned, the infrastructure and resources and processes that we had in place.
And Teresa, forgive me if you mentioned this earlier, but on average, how long do people who are applying for asylum have to wait until their cases are heard?
It depends a little bit on how they are treated. So, you know, previous administrations and this administration have tried to create expedited dockets, if you will, or expedited processes for people that are encountered at the border. And that could mean that their cases may be heard within a year or two. But on average, all immigration court case hearings right now are averaging 3 to 5 years. There's almost 2 million cases pending in our U.S. immigration courts right now.
Wow. We have a question here from Rick, who says, why is the U.S. still giving foreign aid to countries like Venezuela when it's not going to the people in those countries who need it? Should we stop the flow of aid? Teresa, I'll direct that to you, and then we'll go to Hamid next.
Well, I would say I'm not totally an expert in foreign aid, but as I understand it, the United States, when we give foreign aid to countries that we don't have, say, diplomatic relationships with their government, like in Venezuela, usually that aid is not going to the government. It is going to maybe nonprofit or humanitarian organizations in that country that are trying to get that aid to the people who need it. That is not always successful, especially when the government kind of opposes this. But that's at least what the government tries to do.
Yeah. And Hamid, how would you characterize from your work the relationship that we have with the governments of Mexico currently and other Latin American countries that are all part of this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Mexico, you've seen in the last several years Mexico becoming an especially key partner in this migration issue. The tactic during the Trump administration was to threaten Mexico to implement the things they, you know, the Trump administration wanted on immigration, with you know, obviously blocking, you know, closing the border and all kinds of economic means. I think there was some tweet that Trump had about tariffs. The Biden administration has taken a different approach. They're really trying to work diplomatically and, you know, have several meetings with Mexican leaders. You know, you'll see every couple weeks, every couple months, Biden administration leaders meeting with Mexican officials in Mexico City to discuss migration. And I think one of the things they're ultimately trying to do is to make this issue a regional issue and to get more countries involved and to help, you know, really stem this, you know, increase in migration that's coming from, you know, several countries and many countries now, as opposed to Mexico and just Central America. So, you know, they hosted a meeting in Los Angeles earlier this summer, you know, as a way to try to, you know, have some cooperation with other countries. But it's unclear what really what firm ideas and programs are going to come of that so-called Los Angeles Declaration on Migration. So we'll see.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned just a moment ago when you talked about the Trump administration and the relationship with Mexico. And, of course, we all remember former President Trump talking about building the wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. And then he wanted Congress to pay for it. And it was a long story. A portion of the wall got built. Whatever happened? What was the bottom line with the wall and where did it all end up, Hamid?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were able to build, you know, part of the wall. I mean, I think the issue ultimately came, there were lawsuits, and there was such a, I think, big promise made around the wall and getting Mexico to pay for it. They weren't ultimately able to get there, and I think some of that money that had been earmarked for the wall has been distributed to other places in the government. I'm not entirely sure where, but I know that the Biden administration was not going to continue with that same effort.
We want to talk more about the Biden administration and how it is handling all of this and the pressure that it is feeling from various quarters. When we come right back, we are talking about immigration reform and why it has been so very difficult to come up with a solution that works for all concerned. That's what we're talking about on Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about immigration reform. Of course, it kind of got put back on the front burner last week when Florida Governor Ron DeSantis flew two plane loads of Venezuelan asylum seekers to Martha's Vineyard, unannounced. And so, of course, that got everyone talking about immigration reform and back to the central question of why it is so very difficult to come up with a workable solution that is humane, but that also takes into account the very real national security implications. We have two guests with us who are helping us to understand this issue better. Teresa Cardinal Brown is Managing Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Also with us is Hamid Ali Aziz, who covers immigration policy for the Los Angeles Times. And as we are having this conversation, there is a TV monitor in the studio with me where I'm watching on CNN with the volume turned down and seeing that New York is about to open some emergency centers and shelters for asylum seekers, which leads me to a question from Martha, who asks, I don't understand why all the governors don't get together and just spread out the number of migrants to the state so that everyone shares the burden and can offer people the services they need. Teresa Cardinal Brown, I'll direct that one to you.
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I think that's one that we should be asking. And I sort of said that earlier in the hour. You know, if you take away the politics and the political stunts that are clearly involved in the Republican governors trying to, you know, shuttle people to Democratic strongholds or remote places like Martha's Vineyard, the idea of helping migrants get other places in the country where they can receive more help is not terrible. It would spread out the burden a little bit. We understand that during the Trump administration, there was some talk about the government sending ICE being the one to do the transportation, and it was nixed. And I understand that that's under discussion in this administration as well. As I said earlier, these small towns have been bearing this burden for many, many years now. And it certainly does. If this is how it's going to go, if we're going to continue to release people into the country, then certainly spreading that burden makes sense. But I think the bigger question is, how long can we keep managing this volume in this way? Yeah. And I think that's a different question that we need to answer.
And Hamid Aliaziz, President Biden promised to reverse many of former President Trump's immigration policies. And you've described how the administration has gone about doing that to some degree. What's the view within the Democratic Party? Is he doing enough in the view of the Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, I think within certain sectors of the party, they see President Biden as somebody who's fulfilled a lot of, the campaign promises that he made. But there are other areas where, a lot of advocates, especially immigrant advocates, feel like he could do more. I mean, there's this idea around immigration detention, that should be scaled back even more, brought to a minuscule amount. And while this administration has closed some ICE detention centers, it has not, completely brought down that system. But I think the main criticism of this administration was that they were continuing in place that Title 42 measure that we've discussed, which blocks asylum seekers from seeking protection at the border and allows border agents to turn them back. The Biden administration kept that in place up until this spring. That was the main criticism from a lot of Democrats was, why are you keeping in this Trump administration policy? And that has, led to a lot of people being turned back and not having access to asylum. But this administration did that this spring. But like many of their efforts on immigration, they were blocked by a federal court who forced them to continue with Title 42. So I think one of the main problems this administration has had is the federal courts blocking a lot of their efforts.
And there's also the Department of Homeland Security in all of this. And you've written about this, Hamid, about, DHS's concerns about some of the optics of deporting families. You've written about the dedicated docket. Can you talk about that tension between the White House and DHS?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, concern around appearing too soft, about having not having any consequences for people in this country who have gone through the asylum process, gone through the immigration court process, and been ordered deported. And, this fear that if there isn't some sort of consequence, if there isn't deportation, that will be a pull factor, will cause more people to want to come to the border. They'll feel that they, even if they get ordered deported in the United States, they can stay. I think one of the issues with a dedicated docket, which was this effort put in place by the Biden administration to speed up cases of families arriving at the border, was just that when you speed up this process, there can be a lot of issues, some of these families not having access to attorneys, not getting notices of when to appear in court. There were some problems, and some of these people were actually ordered deported without them even present in court. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think the optics of deporting families can be quite challenging. And, there's officers who have to show up and take families and put them in cars, and it can be a particularly traumatic event. And I think so that's the struggle. And this administration is just how much should we focus on deterrence? How much should we focus on trying to provide, more pathways to come to the United States? What's the best balance? And I think that's still an ongoing debate in the party, the Democratic Party.
And Teresa, to that point, is there a sense in which the more we crack down on people trying to enter, the bigger the problem becomes? And by that I mean, as you pointed out, there was a time decades ago when the border was much more porous. People were able to come and go. But now with it being more difficult, for those who do get in, you're going to want to stay and you're going to want your family with you. So is there sort of this dynamic where the more we try to crack down, the bigger the problem gets?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we've learned is that every strategy of enforcement has unintended consequences, right? So you go back to the early 1990s, we first started this idea that we'll fortify the crossings in the cities like San Diego or El Paso, and that will push migrants to go through more desolate and remote places, which are very much harsher, and that would be a deterrent for them to cross, except it didn't work out that way. That's just where they went, if that's where they had to go to cross. You know, we have seen various efforts at deterrence, and I think what we are seeing right now, and I think this goes to the change in the demographics and the desperation of the people coming, is that harsher deterrence is not really having any long-term effect on the numbers, but it is changing how they arrive and where they arrive to. And it's basically putting all of this now in the hands of these criminal smuggling organizations, which, you know, they are criminal businesses, and they have a business imperative to find clients for their work. And so they are in the habit of promising all kinds of things to migrants, whether true or not, about how they can get to the border and what's going to happen to them once they arrive. And they adapt very, very quickly. So, you know, if Mexico is allowing us to send back, you know, Central Americans, El Salvadorans, Hondurans, Guatemalans to Mexico under Title 42, but we can't, they won't take back Venezuelans, Cubans, and Nicaraguans, then the smugglers will go after that population, and that's, we'll see an increase in those folks coming. It is a continuous, challenge to match what we try to do at the border to the strategies that we have available. I would say that, though, our, you know, several decades long policy of the primary strategy at the border being this prevention through deterrence, which is make it harsh to cross, have consequences for people that do cross, have them removed quickly, and try to prevent as many people from making the trip, is no longer having the returns, and we need to adopt different strategies for a different population.
Question from Sammy, who says, how many migrants stay where they are processed? Teresa, I'll direct that to you.
Very, very few stay, in part because the smugglers are bringing them to these small locations, because they know that that means that the Border Patrol and everybody else will have to direct a lot of resources toward managing them. And then for that number that are trying to sneak by, it's easier for them to do so. You know, almost never is this small town in Texas or this small town in Arizona the destination that migrants are heading toward. They want to go to places either where they have already family members who are already in the United States, or people, friends from their communities back in their home country that they know, that have networks that can help them settle in, find a job or whatever. Or if they don't have that, they want to go to, you know, a big city that they are aware of that they feel like they will have more opportunity. So that's why I said, in some ways, you know, busing these migrants to some of these large cities can be seen as a help to them in getting to where they ultimately want to go.
Question from Jill, and Hamid, I'll direct this to you. Jill says, you've been talking a lot about people coming to the southern border, but what about immigration from other parts of the world? What about all the educated workers that companies compete for? Are we making it easier or harder for them to get in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Biden administration is trying to, you know, embrace this effort of the legal pathways to come to the United States. I think earlier this month there was a report that the green cards that are available for some of these immigrant workers, the slots that are available for them, all of them were filled up, and all of the green cards that were available were distributed to workers, which is something that hadn't been happening in the past. But I think that's one area where maybe Republicans and Democrats could work together, because, you know, you see from companies, especially in Silicon Valley, this focus on really offering ways for workers, especially high-skilled workers in STEM, to remain in the United States, and that boosts, you know, our economy and national security in some areas. So that may be an area where Democrats and Republicans could work together.
Yeah. Teresa, we have a question from Jane, who is asking about DACA. This was one of my questions as well. We heard a lot about the Dreamers. President Obama, by executive order, created an opportunity for them to remain in the country. What's the update on DACA?
Well, there's been lots of ups and downs since 2012 when President Obama created the DACA program. As you mentioned, it was created via a memorandum. President Trump, when he came into office, said he wanted to terminate the program, but he delayed that decision to give Congress an opportunity to try to pass legislation that would protect the DACA recipients and other Dreamers. There were attempts at that in 2017 and into 2018 that frankly failed Congress. The deals that could be cut were not able to succeed. In some cases, the president changed his mind about what he was willing to sign off on. In the meantime, there were lawsuits. As Hamed said, much of immigration policy right now is being handled via lawsuits in federal courts. But there were lawsuits against the administration's termination of the program. Various court cases, including a Supreme Court decision, kept the program alive, said that the president's attempt to terminate it did not meet the procedural requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, which governs executive actions. And so the program remained in place. President Biden came in and said, we're going to restart the program. And then he was sued by the states of Texas and other states. A judge in the Southern District of Texas ruled that the program was likely illegal, that President Obama did not have the authority to create it in 2012. He stayed his decision while an appeal is pending in the Fifth Circuit. The judge there has heard that appeal, and we're frankly expecting a decision out of that appellate court any day now. It's widely expected that that Fifth Circuit would uphold the lower court's decision, which would mean that the case would probably make its way to the Supreme Court next year. But if the program is ruled illegal, it would not only stop any new applicants from coming into the program, which has been the case since the original decision that the Texas judge made, but would end the program for existing DACA holders. Once their current status ends, most likely that would be the last that they would get. So it really falls on Congress frankly, it always had. When President Obama created the program, he said, hopefully this is a stopgap until Congress can come together and do something. And it's, you know, more than a decade later, and Congress still hasn't been able to come together to do that.
Well, it's the political will that seems to be lacking for so many of these decisions, or just trying to bring the two sides together. It's not like it was in 86 when legislation was passed by President Reagan. It was a democratically controlled House and Senate, but it seems that those days are behind us. Teresa, in our last minute to a minute and a half, you've laid out a roadmap for how to create a working immigration system. And I know that this is a very short time, but give us, you know, one or two key points that you think need to happen on the road to getting a more workable system.
Well, you know, going back to where we started the conversation, this idea of comprehensive immigration reform is actually those three pillars: modernizing and simplifying and streamlining our legal immigration system so that it meets the needs that we have in our country for family unification and our economy. Addressing the situation at the border. We need to manage this much, much better. It cannot continue the way it is. I think that's increasingly a common perception among Democrats and Republicans. And lastly, there's widespread support across the parties for providing a pathway to legal status for most of the undocumented people who are in the United States who otherwise, would be able to support our country in multiple ways.
Yeah. So it sounds like there is some potential for movement.
Yeah, I think, you know, political will, as you said, is a limiting factor on all of this.
We have been talking about immigration reform and how we get to a solution that works for all concerned. Our guests have been Teresa Cardinal Brown, Managing Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Hamid Ali Aziz, who covers immigration policy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer today was Al Banks. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.